Gerhard Erdl. He was born in Stuttgart, to be more precise, actually in Bad Cannstatt, which is on the other side of the river, Neckar River. And then he studied at the University of Stuttgart physics and performed his diploma work at the Max Planck Institute for Metal Research, a very famous institute. After his diploma work, he moved to the Technical University of Munich, where he received his PhD degree in 1965. And astonishingly, he finished his habilitation just 3 years later in 1967. He became, very young at that stage, full professor at the physical chemistry department in Hannover. After that, he got an offer from Ludwig Maximilian University, where he went back to Munich. And finally, in 1986, he became director of the Institute of Physical Chemistry at Fritz Haber Institute in Berlin, a very famous place. With this move to the Fritz Haber Institute, a cycle of scientific family relation closed. One of the Fritz Haber's scientific collaborators was Karl Friedrich Bonhoeffer from 1923 to 1930, who became scientific director of the Fritz Haber Institute from 1948 to 1949. He was a thesis advisor of Heinz Gerischer, who became director of the Franz Haber Institute in 1973, and who turned the directorship finally over to his former student, Gerhard Erdl. So, also in science, we have families, and again, this is very important. Gerhard Erdl is also an honorary professor of the Free University, the Technical University, and the Humboldt University in Berlin, all three universities there. And he took guest professorships at the University of California in Berkeley, Caltech, University of Wisconsin, and in 1994 was summit professor at the Goethe University in Frankfurt. His major scientific interest is the microscopic investigation of catalytic surface processes. His pioneering experiments on surfaces performed his newly developed surface physical methodology under ultra-high vacuum conditions allowed for the first time to understand such processes on an atomistic level and with high time resolution. Spatial-temporal nonlinear effects were observed in real time on microscopic down to atomistic resolution. Amoniosynthesis had, in addition to other reactions, always been one of Gerhard Erdl's key interests. Gerhard Erdl's group showed via the application of advanced surface methods that the activity of the active species in the ammonia synthesis is dissociatively absorbed atomic nitrogen, which became step-wise hydrogenated. And in parallel to these fundamental experiments on model substrates, on pure substrates under ultra-high vacuum conditions, research from his institute performed on real powder catalysts could also show that ruthenium-based catalysts could be technically interesting and beneficial to classical iron catalysts. Work in this and in other directions had made many contributions to a fundamental atomistic understanding of catalysts. Gerhard Erdl is a member of prestigious scientific academies and societies and has received several honorary doctoral degrees from universities in Germany, Sweden, Denmark, Belgium. His scientific work was honored by numerous awards, just to mention, as already said by our president, the Nobel Prize for Chemistry in 2007, institute buildings, centers, high schools, scientific awards are named after him. In 2007, Gerhard Erdl received here in Frankfurt in the Paulskirche the Otto Hahn Prize. I remember very well his very impressive speech at that time, at this occasion. One aspect was very interesting for me. On the one hand, he thanked his co-workers in a very respectful and fair way, acknowledging that experimental science needs not only a good idea, but also a very good teamwork. On the other hand, he thanked the German Research Society, especially for supporting him by individual grants called Normalverfahren, which he acknowledged as the most effective instrument for the support of innovative new ideas and pioneering experimental work, as best demonstrated in his case. So I'm very happy that we have him here as a speaker on this very nice symposium, and I'm looking forward to your presentation.
Proceeds with a rate which is faster than that without catalyst. That's the essence of iterations catalysis. It's the basis of chemical industry, which forms about 80% of its products through heterogeneous catalysis, even on the largest scale, as already mentioned, the Haber-Bosch process, the formation of ammonia from nitrogen and hydrogen, which was introduced about 100 years ago. And nevertheless, it took more than 70 years to explore the detailed mechanism of this reaction. The significance of these reactions becomes obvious if we look at the development of the world population with time and the production of ammonia. Ammonia is the basis of fertilizers, and without the ammonia production, population of the world would not be the same as it is now. There's an estimated about 1/3 of the world population would starve if the Haber-Bosch process would not be available. Nevertheless, it took very long to understand the progress of this reaction. And this has to do with the complexity of the catalyst and the whole process. The catalyst was developed just 100 years ago by Alvin Mittasch, and it's based on an iron oxide with small amounts of additional elements like potassium, aluminum and calcium. And this is a micrograph of the catalyst surface, shows these small particles here on the nanometers scale, and these larger parts here. And the active parts are these one here. And its overall component composition is essentially iron oxide, Fe3O4. But if you look at the surface composition, so the composition of the topmost surface layer, then it's quite different. In the unreduced state, there's very little iron on the surface. There's a strong enrichment of the elements potassium and aluminum. Under reaction conditions, the surface becomes reduced. We have a small increase of the iron concentration. And if you like, look at these parts here, these are the active ones. These are inactive oxide particles. The active spot consists essentially of iron and potassium atoms with compensation by oxygen. These elements, these additional elements, act as promoters. The iron increases activity by the presence of potassium, which enhances the possibility for dissociation of nitrogen. The other elements, aluminum and potassium, act as so-called structural promoters. They form a framework between these particles here, which prevents sintering of the catalyst particles. So the structural promoters keep the surface area high, while potassium is an electronic promoter, it modifies the local chemical reactivity of the iron surfaces. In the meantime, we know the mechanism of this reaction, and it's summarized here, again in the energy diagram. We start with nitrogen and hydrogen, and end up with ammonia, reaction enthalpy. And if without a catalyst, we would need a very high amount of energy in order to split the nitrogen-hydrogen bond. Nitrogen-hydrogen atom combinations and would go downwards to the final product. But this energy, of course, is prohibitive. The catalyst offers an alternative way by adsorbing the nitrogen and hydrogen molecules onto the surface. The nitrogen is dissociatively adsorbed to nitrogen atoms. It recombines with hydrogen atoms stepwise to NH, NH2, NH3, and the final released in the gas phase. This is the essence of a heterogeneous catalyst. So instead of exploring now in detail these processes here, the elementary steps, I will go to a much simpler reaction, which is also very important, namely oxidation of carbon monoxide, as in your car exhaust catalyst. Your car exhaust catalyst, you have a ceramic body with small metal particles of platinum, rhodium, which expose different crystal planes. And this cartoon marks the elementary steps involved in the oxidation of carbon monoxide. Carbon monoxide is adsorbed through the carbon atom. Oxygen atoms are formed through dissociation of the oxygen molecule, and then the species migrate on the surface, they may recombine the CO2, which is released in the gas phase. These are small particles. And, this figure here shows such a typical supporting catalyst. It's typically an oxide, in this case magnesium oxide, with small ruthenium particles on the nanometer scale. Why? The reactivity depends on the size of the surface. The overall size of the surface per gram of catalyst will increase if you have finely divided particles. And that's why very often these particles are the nanometer scale. Catalysis was the nanotechnology long before this term was invented. These are small particles, and this is a high resolution electron microscope showing this atomic resolution, these metal atoms. And this is a small model of this catalyst particle, just exposing different crystal planes and all the defect sites like the steps and so on. And this explains why this is such a complicated matter to investigate the elementary steps in heterogeneous catalysis. And one way to overcome this difficulty consists in just selecting single crystal planes of this nature and to study the behavior of these single crystallographic planes in contact with the molecules of the gas phase. Now we have seen that the decisive step is always the dissociation of the molecule. Also, carbon monoxide oxidation, the oxidation takes place through recombination between carbon monoxide and oxygen atoms. So the oxygen molecule has to dissociate. And how is this achieved by the catalyst? This is again an energy diagram. The diatomic molecule approaching a catalyst, in this case a single crystal plane, one on one, and this is a two-dimensional energy diagram. The energy is a function of the separation of the molecule from the surface, x, and the separation between the two atoms. The molecule approaches the surface, becomes weakly adsorbed as a molecule, and this is minimum here, and then by dissociation, the molecule separates into two atoms, which become then can be solved as atoms on the surface. And this barrier here marks the probability for dissociation, the activation energy for dissociation. It's the secret of the catalyst to keep this barrier as low as possible. But it's quite obvious, deeper, this minimum here where we end up, the lower will be the activation barrier for dissociation, but the more strongly will the atoms be added. And then the first reaction is slowed down. So we always find a compromise between a low activation barrier and a not too strong bonding of the resulting surface. This is why for certain reactions, always certain types of catalysts are preferred. This is the result of an experiment where we have looked at the surface with atomic resolution using this atomic tunneling microscope. This is the platinum 111 surface. These are the platinum atoms on the surface. And it's now exposed to a small amount of oxygen molecules at 165 Kelvin. And as a result, we see these two features, always pairs of loose structures. These are the oxygen atoms resulting from the dissociation of the oxygen molecules. If you would do this experiment at 100 Kelvin, you would find the molecules. Then the activation energy of the dissociation would be too high, but at 165, they can dissociate. And we see the following. At this temperature, the molecules are immobile on the surface. They stay there forever. They stay in separations of 5 to 8 angstroms. They are not in nearby sites, but they are separated by several angstroms. Because by dissociation, the energy of the absorption bond has to be released to the lattice of the solid. And this takes some time. We know the energy, we know the separation, so we can estimate the time for relaxation of the energy. In this case, it's about 300 femtoseconds. This is a typical time scale for the energy exchange between solid and the molecules. So processes take place on a time scale below a picosecond and can be probed by ultra-fast laser techniques. You see further that these bright dots which mark the position of the oxygen atoms are surrounded by dark areas. That's because this technique probes not only the topography but also the local electronic structure. Oxygen is electronegative, it withdraws electronic charge from the substrate, and there will be a depletion of electronic charge around the molecules. And this causes a local modification of the electronic structure of the surface, giving rise to indirect interactions between particles on the surface through this local electronic interaction. And these interactions can be repulsive as well as protective, and they are very important for the following. So, if you now go up with temperature, the particles will start to move across the surface, and if you make an experiment with oxygen at room temperature on the helium surface, you have to record this image in about 70 milliseconds in order to have a snapshot of the adsorbed elements on the surface. So it's a random distribution because the molecules dissociate, the atoms jump across the surface, we have a random distribution of energy on the surface. And if you look at the energetics again, an atom interacting with the surface is bound by the adsorption energy, and this gives rise to surface lifetime determined by the depth of this potential well. If instead we move now a particle from one side to the next one, the potential will vary periodically according to the periodic structure of the surface, and then this residence time at a certain site will be smaller. It's only the activation energy of the surface diffusion. So the particle jumps across the surface many, many times before eventually it can leave. If we go up with temperatures, it will become shorter. So we need a very rapid instrument to really follow the atoms on the surface, and this can be seen in this figure here. This is to a short movie now. With the oxygen atoms on the ruthenium surface, as shown before, at room temperature, in real time, what they are doing if we follow sulfate. They move around the surface like in Brownian motion, random, jumping from one side to the other. However, if you look closer, how long do they stay in the surface line? It turns out that this residence time depends on the neighborhood. If they come closer to each other, if they are staying only two legs at constant apart from each other, they stay together longer because there's a weak attractive interaction. And this gives rise to a new phenomenon if it increases the surface concentration. The surface concentration, which is now a random distribution at slope coverage, gives now rise to a separation into two phases. It's essentially a two-dimensional crystal and a two-dimensional gas phase. The phase actually occurs in two dimensions, that's this elevated concentrations, and there's a continuous evaporation from the crystals into the gas phase and condensation back. It's like a sublimation equilibrium between the solid and the gas phase. So this is a fate of particles on the surface. And you see the formation of all the structures is more the rule than the exception. And this gives us the possibility to determine the structure of these phases by diffraction techniques, electron diffraction. And with our example of oxygen and carbon monoxide, and then oxygen carbon monoxide on platinum, these are the resulting structures. Oxygen atoms form this mesh, open mesh, separated by two lattice constants, where the oxygen atoms are located in threefold hollow sets, while the carbon monoxide molecules are coupled to the surface through the carbon atom, and in this case, from either on top or bridge positions, in a densely packed layer. And this is a consequence. If we start with a CO-covered surface, expose it to oxygen, the surface will be completely blocked for oxygen absorption. The CO is poison, because the oxygen does not find enough free sites for dissociation. Like in a biological system, where oxygen uptake is blocked by carbon monoxide. While the oxygen atoms, on the other hand, form this open mesh, and it is inside the system mesh, a CO molecule may well be absorbed as a mixed phase. So if we start with an oxygen-covered surface, expose it to carbon monoxide, this unit cells may be occupied against this mixed phase, and we have boundaries between the different islands, and we find sites where the oxygen atoms, the threefold sites, are close to bridge CO molecules. They are very close contact, and that's the site where the reaction takes place. So if you again look now on atomic scale for the progress of the reaction, starting with an oxygen-covered surface, exposed to carbon monoxide, we form this mixed phase, and at the boundaries, these are the pure CO phases. At the boundaries, the growth of pure CO phase takes place where the oxygen is reacted off to the changes of CO molecules. And if you not put everything together, we get the mechanism of this reaction, which is summarized again here. CO forms a densely packed layer, and if the concentration is too high, oxygen cannot be absorbed. While on the other hand, oxygen forms an open layer, and it depends on oxygen atoms, carbon monoxide may be absorbed. If the CO coverage is too high, the catalyst doesn't work instead. The only way to overcome this problem is to go up with energy, with the temperature, to the part of the CO molecules is dissolving back into the gas phase. That's why your car exhaust catalyst does not work in the cold. The rid of part of the carbon monoxide in order to enable the uptake of oxygen. And then oxygen and CO will be combined with CO2, and this is the energy diagram. CO and oxygen are absorbed on the surface by overcoming a relatively small activation barrier on a kilojoule per mole. They form CO2, which is so weakly held on the surface that it's immediately released back into the gas phase. So this is perhaps the simplest case of a heterogeneously catalyzed reactions. But we know that our catalyst surface is by far more complex. And there's at least one kind of sites on the surface always available, namely step sites. Never a perfect single crystal surface, but there are always monatomic steps available. And this figure now shows what happens if the diatomic molecule involved is interacting with the surface, exhibiting monatomic steps. Say O is dissociated at the steps, and these dark red triangles here are the nitrogen atoms, the streaks here are the oxygen atoms, resulting from the dissociation. The oxygen atoms are more mobile than the nitrogen atoms, and that's why they are distributed already across the surface, while the nitrogen atoms take longer, 2 hours, to spread across the surface. But it's clear dissociation takes place at the step site. That the step atom has fewer nearest neighbors than an atom inside the surface, and that's why its activation energy for dissociation is smaller. And since rates are always exponentially dependent on energies, a small change in the activation energy will have a dramatic effect. There's another effect. If you look at the concentration of nitrogen atoms for certain exposure, within a certain length of the steps, it turns out the wider the terrace, the more and more molecules will be dissociated. So obviously the terraces are also of significance. And this illustrated by the figure here. The NO molecules are adsorbed on the terraces everywhere. They diffuse very rapidly across the surface. And they reach a step, they dissociate, and then the atoms move apart again. So the wider the step, the wider the terrace, the higher the concentration of NO, the higher the probability of dissociation. This shows this interplay between the different structural elements of the surface. These step elements, these step surfaces, can also move away from the step. So it's always a dynamic process. And this gives authority to the observation very often that the catalyst itself changes its structure under the action of the catalytic reaction. For example, if you take such a ruthenium surface, expose it to carbon monoxide with oxygen, it will be a very, very bad catalyst for carbon monoxide oxidation, because the oxygen atoms are so strongly held at the surface that they cannot react. But as time passes, the surface transforms slowly from this part here with chemisorbed oxygen atoms to another phase. And the another phase shown here is the 110 plane of ruthenium dioxide overlay. Very thin, two-atomic bigger, the thick layer of ruthenium dioxide. That means the structural transformation of the surface causes the catalyst to become a better catalyst, and this is the structural resulting effects. It's the ruthenium dioxide, which exposes oxygen atoms in bridge positions and coordinatively unsaturated ruthenium atoms, onto which the carbon monoxide or also oxygen atoms can be adsorbed. There are two types of oxygen now. The bridge atoms, which are part of the stoichiometric surface, and the additionally absorbed oxygen atoms. And we can now take this vibrational spectrum as a fingerprint for the state of the surface. If we start with the surface covered by oxygen in these two states and expose it to carbon monoxide at room temperature, increasing exposure amount of CO molecules, this species will disappear and will be replaced by this new state here. This is the carbon monoxide, the stretch vibration of the carbon monoxide. And on the other hand, if we have now saturated the surface with carbon monoxide, exposed to oxygen, the CO will be consumed and the oxygen will build up again. This is a classical example of the so-called Langmuir-Hirschfeld type of catalytic reaction, where adsorbed species may be formed through interaction with free sites, either oxygen atoms or carbon monoxide molecules, and there's a recombining from CO2. And theory is now able to really calculate the energetics of such a process, where we have on such a surface CO and oxygen adsorbed on adjacent coordinated substrate sides of the surface. And if you look at the energetics as a function of the position of the CO molecule and the oxygen atom, these are the two positions, you see that the recombination takes place with an activation in the barrier of about 0.6. This will result of a EFT calculation without any adjustable parameters. And the result of the theory can now even be taken and calculate the rate of a catalytic reaction and compare it with the experimental value. And this is the result shown here. Again, this carbon monoxide oxidation on the residuum dioxide surface, which depends on the oxygen pressure, the CO pressure and temperature. We keep oxygen pressure constant, temperature constant, we record the steady state rate of CO2 formation as a function of the CO pressure. The rate goes up, reaches a maximum. The maximum is reached when we have equal numbers of CO molecules and carbon monoxide and oxygen atoms on the surface. And if we increase the CO pressure further, the rate will decrease again. These are absolute numbers, so-called turnover frequencies, the number of CO2 molecules formed per second per site. And this is a result of this relative treatment combining EFT with classical and quantum mechanical Monte Carlo simulations. And the agreement is really surprisingly good because it's again an absolute quantitative theory without any adjustable parameter. You have the same order of turnover frequency and where the maximum is reached. This gives us a feeling that in fact catalysis is now in a state where it transforms from a black art into a real science, where also theory is able to really predict and reproduce the experimental findings. However, the situation becomes more complex if we go to another system. Again, carbon monoxide oxidation on platinum on zero surfaces are overplayed, and under these conditions, the temperature, CO pressure, and oxygen pressure will change the oxygen pressure at this point, and we see that CO2 formation increases slowly, and then it starts to oscillate periodically. The microscopic crystal shows macroscopic rate oscillations, something which is really very unusual. Chemistry, we already think if we keep everything constant, then also the result will be a constant steady state. But this is obviously not the case. This is a kind of self-organization, somewhat different from what Jean-Marie Lane was discussing, self-organization on a macroscopic scale, temporal self-organization. And this is a phenomenon which is found also by different other fields. The whole field of biology consists of this self-organization, macroscopic self-organization phenomenon. And if you look on population dynamics, we find an example to differentiate the number of furs or hares and lynxes, bobcats, which were delivered to the Hudson's Bay Company as a function of time. If they're not constant, they're oscillating. They are periodically oscillating, and there's always a phase lag between the number of hairs and the number of lynxes. And it's quite understandable, plausible, what is the reason for that? The two species interact with each other. And if there are many hairs, since the lynxes will not be large enough, and they will meet, and they will increase their population, they increase them even more until there are no longer enough hairs available, which start to decay. And with some time delay, the lynxes will start to starve, and the whole case will start from the beginning again. This phenomenon was known for mathematicians since long times, and in the 20s, a simple mathematical model was developed by Lotka and Volterra, which expresses the concentration changes of the hairs and the bobcats in terms of two coupled ordinary differential equations. Change of the concentration of hair is proportional to the concentration, the birth rate, minus the interaction with the lung lenses. This is a transition state here. And on the other hand, change concentration of the lenses, change with time proportional to the supply of food, x times y, minus the natural depth rate. And if you solve these two coupled nonlinear differential equations, under certain conditions, the results will indeed not be constant, but they will oscillate. And this is exactly what is found in experiments. And this gave the whole field the name nonlinear dynamics, because this is very characteristic for the systems described by nonlinear differential equations. These are ordinary differential equations. There is no spatial coordinate. But in fact, in reality, of course, if we have a large area with hairs and bobcats, there must be some kind of synchronization. Otherwise, you wouldn't expect that the whole population goes up and down. And this kind of synchronization takes place through transport processes. The animals migrate across the surface, described by diffusion. And that's why these systems showing this kind of macroscopic self-organization are characterized always that they are open systems, far away from equilibrium, otherwise we wouldn't have this temporal variation. And we have, apart from the reaction, this reaction term here, we have another term, which is transport. This transport can be either diffusion, we have a high concentration here, then here, so the part is diffused. If we have higher temperature here, then here, so we have heat flow, higher concentration here, if the reactivity is different, we have heat flow. We have coupling through the gas phase. If we have higher consumption of molecules here than here, the molecules in the gas phase will move across the surface very rapidly, much, much faster than events on the surface. This causes some global coupling that all the parts of the surface will be synchronized. And this can also be achieved by electrical fields in certain cases. So, this coupling of reaction and diffusion, that's essential. And if we look first at the heat problems, there's one example where we have very thin catalyst, 200 nanometers, 5 millimeter in diameter, which is exposed to carbon monoxide and oxygen under conditions where the whole rate is periodically oscillating. It's so thin that the temperature changes which are associated with the reaction cause a deformation of the catalyst. So we can follow the periodic oscillation by deformation of the catalyst foil. And this shows how this heat conduction transmits the reactivity over the across the whole surface. This periodic variation of deformation is like a heartbeat, that's why we call it heartbeats of a catalyst. The normal situation will be only with diffusion. The temperature differential will be too small, it's only diffusion, and then we have concentration differences. And then we have to look at concentration changes within the adsorbed species. Two-dimensional chemistry. If you look first in other areas of chemistry, you find a very famous example, the Golubchuk-Chapotinsky reaction. We have exactly this kind of pattern formation. This is macroscopic, 5 centimeters. And we, due to the different color of the different species involved, we get this fine kind of pattern formations that look like targets, as I call it, or target patterns as they expand. And exactly the same behavior can be found on our surface species. If we probe the concentration of the surface concentrations with an instrument which is well developed in our institute, the photoimaging electron microscope, and you which is shown here. Parts of the surface covered by carbon monoxide are bright, and parts covered by oxygen are dark. And this is a surface which is anisotropic, so diffusion is along this direction, is faster than along this direction. So that's why these are ellipses and not circular patterns. These are the steady state conditions, oxygen, CO, temperature, everything is constant. But nevertheless, under these conditions, we get this oscillatory behavior of the kinetics associated with this kind of pattern formation. And this is now, again in real time, this kind of pattern formation, the length scale, 500 micrometers, and we show this expanding ellipses, and the background is switching between bright and dark, reflecting the overall oscillatory behavior of the kinetics. So it obviously we have a part from the coupling through diffusion or the coupling through the gas phase if the whole surface is synchronized. And if we go to other conditions, we get pure coupling through the gas phase and we get standing waves as shown here. Standing waves, the whole surface is oscillating synchronously in phase. In this case, the information is transported through gas phase and diffusion of the molecule. The fastest information transfer is by light. And there's one example in nature where you can really observe this coupling of different species through light with fireflies. Colonies of fireflies in Malaysia. These are the fireflies. They are located in such colonies and they are blinking periodically. And they are completely perfectly synchronized to light. Only the propagation of these patterns across the surface. The dark parts are oxygen covered, they have a higher reactivity. On these parts, on each side, about 10 CO2 molecules are formed per second, while the waves themselves propagate with a much slower speed of like several micrometers per second. So, no coupling of the direct elementary steps, the chemical reaction, and the propagation across the surface of the diffusion because of this reaction, which is exciting, very precise. Now, spirals is something we also observe in many, many systems in nature. Even the largest systems we know, spiral galaxies, show spirals or arcanes. They're very common. Effect in nature, distance far away from equilibrium, shows this effect of spiral reformation. With our system, we know everything. The reactions, the diffusion coefficients, and that's why we can also try to simulate these effects on the computer, just writing down the differential equations and let the computer run. And this is done here. We start with a random distribution oxygen, carbon monoxide in certain conditions. Spiral waves are starting to form and we this is very perfect spiral waves. This is linked to a very special set of conditions. If we change the set of conditions a little bit, then also the patterns change. In this case, you start again with spiral wave formation, but now the spirals break up and become disordered. This is a state of spatiotemporal chaos, or a chemical turbulence. And this again can be observed in experiment. We start with this spiral waves, and under these conditions, the spiral waves break up and form this chaotic or turbulent state. So this is an example of complexity in microscopic world observed with a very simple surface reaction under well-defined conditions. It shows us that indeed we will be able to modulate